don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. Got a quick read for you today. This will be the first one I've read from Alexander Svetsky. I've read a number of his articles recently. The first one I stumbled on is the one we'll read today. It's titled Homo Sapiens, Evolution, Money, and Bitcoin. I just finished part one, which I don't think part two or part three is out yet. Part one of his Bitcoin versus Bcash article. And I probably will hit that one soon, but not right now. I think we've talked enough on the Bitcoin versus Bcash stuff for the time being, so I want to take a different approach. And then also, I might, depending on how long it is, because part one's like 20 minutes-ish, probably 25 if I'm reading out loud, I may actually do part one, two, and three all together as a definitive three-part Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash kind of thing. But with that, let's go ahead and jump in to today's article, which he posted on May 7th, so it's roughly 2 weeks ago. And just a heads up, he tends to curse a bit in his articles, so if you got sensitive ears, I will probably be censoring the F word, but likely I won't bother with anything else. So just a heads up if you care. But again, this is Homo Sapiens, Evolution, Money, and Bitcoin by Alexander Svetsky. How a Strange Species of Ape Went from Barter to Bitcoin. An essay. Preface. I started writing this damn article about 6 months ago, or maybe longer. I can't even remember now. It's been sitting there with my other 50 unfinished, partly written articles, which I keep saying I'll find the time to finish soon. The information here has formed the basis of a lot of my arguments in the space, and also the basis of a few talks I've given, including one really rough presentation I held in Australia a few months ago that was recorded, linked at the end. My aim is to use history, anthropology, communication, evolution, and more to explore what money is, what Bitcoin is, how they've evolved, what's different this time, and why this innovation is so important. Although I've picked up information from the thousands of books, videos, essays, articles, and blogs I've read over the years, a huge thank you goes to Yuval Noah Harari, Andreas M. Antonopoulos, and Naval Ravikant for being big inspirations. I recommend you find out who each of them are ASAP. So now, well, I'm going to actually try and finish it, or at least make it good enough to release. In the beginning, there was Bitcoin. Bitcoin and blockchain development commenced roughly 70,000 years ago, when Homo sapiens as a species transcended their biological limits. It's a story that has its roots in the evolution of humanity. Humans have been on the planet for over 2 million years. Homo sapiens, as a species of human, have only been around for about 150,000 years. 70,000 years ago, something happened. It's linked to the activation of our prefrontal cortex, the shrinking of our digestive system, and a few other things, and although nobody really knows how it happened, it resulted in us moving from the middle of the food chain to the top of the food chain, very quickly. And this is where the age of history begins, which for humans and the world changed everything. But before we explore what changed, let's get some context. Dunbar's number. Robin Dunbar was a British anthropologist who spent years studying the average social group size and brain function of humans and primates throughout history. His findings led him to posit that, quote, "The human cognitive processing system can tolerate a maximum of 150 friends or stable social relationships. End quote. This 150 has come to be known as Dunbar's number and has held roughly true over the millennia across all species of human and primate. It's considered an evolutionary biological limit that we Homo sapiens still have to this day. But it was the ability to cooperate in groups beyond this number that changed everything 70,000 years ago, the dawn of history. How? Communication. Communication changes everything. But it's not just any form of communication. Animals, mammals, insects, etc. all communicate in their own ways, and as a result build tribes, colonies, packs, etc. In fact, most are way better at organizing and building complex cooperative colonies than humans are. For example, ants. But these groupings and their communication is purely biological. Homo sapiens evolved beyond all other species, including humans, because we were somehow able to communicate on a higher level, transcending our biological constraints. There are two parts to this. One, the foundation. The second, the derivative and key to it all. Part one. Complex language. Quote, language may have arisen as a cheap means of social grooming, allowing early humans to maintain social cohesion efficiently. Without language, Dunbar speculates, humans would have to expend nearly half their time on social grooming, which would have made productive cooperative effort nearly impossible. Language may have allowed societies to remain cohesive while reducing the need for physical and social intimacy. End quote. Source, Wikipedia of Dunbar's number. Complex language was something unique to the way our brain evolved, i.e. the neocortex and prefrontal cortex. It gave us the time, physically and space, cognitively, to build the second layer. Part 2. Shared fictions. We are the only species that is able to communicate about, share, and relate to things that don't actually exist. Monkeys can lie. They can say there's an eagle in the sky to trick their fellow monkey into running, so he gets all the bananas to himself. Monkeys can also warn of danger, i.e. there's a lion at the river. Only Homo sapiens, on the other hand, can say the lion is the spirit ancestor of our people. Only Homo sapiens, who were from different parts of the world, don't know each other, have never met, and have no biological reason to trust each other, can strike up a conversation, build rapport, and build trust simply because they are Italian or Chinese or some other fictitious nationality. Only Homo sapiens can use that same reason to band together and build the pyramids, or blow each other up in, quote, the name of our country, like we did in World War I, World War II, or any other war for that matter. Shared fictions are languages in and of themselves, and over the millennia, there have been many. Castes, races, kings, gods, religions, nations, laws, corporations, and money. All of these are designed to facilitate cooperation, coordination on a broader level, helping to abstract exchange and allowing for a more complex society to grow and evolve. One of the earliest shared fictions was money. And it still exists today because of how fundamentally important it is for society to function. Money and communication. Money, at its very basic level, is a form of communication. Money is a shared fiction. It's an abstraction that we've all agreed represents value. The form of money has evolved over the years, from spices to shells to coins to gold to paper to plastic and now native digital currencies. Money is one of the only forms of communication or shared fiction that has stood the test of time and managed to transcend the borders and barriers all other shared fictions have been restricted by. Not even religion can come close to the power of money. Why? Because of what it represents. Value and exchange. At the very foundation of society and its ability to grow and function is one key ingredient: value. Furthermore, the ability to exchange value is what makes society run. When we cooperate, we are doing work, which has some form of value. And in all our contributions and interactions, we have exchanges of this value. When you extrapolate that out in layers of complexity, you create societies that are able to exceed Dunbar's number by orders of magnitude. It's also important to note that as a society increases in complexity, value will continue to abstract in order to lower the friction of exchange. This is why money is so important. Value is subjective and can come in many forms, but money is an objective tool that gives us an opportunity to represent and quantify it. Money's evolution. Grossly simplified for this essay. Over the centuries, money has come in many, many forms. We went from barter to commodity money like cows and spices, to initial abstractions like shells, to better abstractions like metals such as bronze, then silver, then gold. About 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, we entered the period of layer 2 abstractions, where, quote, trust was introduced to help facilitate better transactions in exchange, i.e. coins were created with the stamp of approval by an emperor or authority. And we've got a graphic here for ancient money and the stages of ancient money, and it starts with 10,000 BC or earlier was barter, then roughly around 9,000 BCE is commodity money. We see cattle, salt, sugar, tobacco, cotton. And then 5,000 BCE, we see stage one of abstractions, shells, rocks, or rhinestones. Then 2,500 BCE, stage two abstractions, metals, bronze, gold, silver, even knives. And then 1,500 BCE, we see gold. This model persisted in many variants over the millennia, in and amongst multiple barter, gold, hyperinflationary coinage eras, etc. Thank you, Nero, for one of the first big ones. Until the next major abstraction, i.e. paper or promissory notes. It was popularized by the Florentine banking families during the Renaissance because it was easier to carry a note that promised the redemption of an amount of gold than having to carry the gold around. And we have a graphic of modern money. Starting with 1000 BCE, we've got coins, ancient, Roman to medieval. Then in the 1500s, we have gold-backed paper money. Then in the 1950s, we have fiat paper money. And then in the 1990s, we get plastic money. And then finally in 2000, money becomes digital. This was the defining model in and amongst periods of gold standards, etc., for 500 years, until the promissory notes transformed into our current era of fiat currency, i.e. a currency that's backed by nothing other than, quote, trust in the state, or trust in the issuer. This fiat currency model has three iterations so far: paper, plastic, and the digital veneer, where we are now. And it has reigned supreme until January of 2009, when Satoshi Nakamoto launched Bitcoin. And the timing could not have been better. Attributes of money. Before we define the quote, money we need, let's review the attributes of money. We have another graphic titled, What is Money? And to the left, we have the definition, which would be a store of value, an abstraction or representation of value, and a measure of wealth. Then we have money's attributes, including fungibility, portability, durability, cognizability, divisibility, and homogeneity. With each abstraction, we are able to add better attributes to money. But with each layer of abstraction, we increased the dependence on trust. The more attributes we added, the more the pillar of trust was shrouded in power, secrecy, and the few. And this is why we need a new form of money. The money we need? What's the ideal type of money or value storage for a world that is becoming increasingly interconnected, is becoming increasingly complex, requires better forms of exchange that are faster and more transparent, needs a more robust, anti-fragile, trustless form of value abstraction, and is moving quickly to one where borders mean less than they used to, and where the language barriers are being broken down to their most fundamental layers. We need a form of value storage and exchange that is open and decentralized, censorship resistant, can be viewed by the public, on a ledger accessible to all with a token that is digital, divisible, fungible, fixed, and finite in supply. And that already exists. It's been staring at us since 2009. Growing up in a digital world, each generation has been conditioned to believe X is real money. Gold and paper backed by, quote, governments or central banks have been the major incumbents for the last few centuries. When we first started moving to plastic, there was an uproar that this was not, quote, real money. The same thing happened with building the digital veneer over money that we use today, but people adapt. And whilst these continual abstractions have come with advantages and disadvantages, they've paved the way for truly native digital global currencies, stores of value, and means of exchange to emerge. For some of us, it still seems like internet funny money, but for the next generation, paper, cash, and plastic will seem like useless relics of the past. Native digital currencies are the future, and most importantly, those that are decentralized, borderless, global, and censorship-resistant, because technology is democratizing everything else, and we need a form of money to go with it. A digital store of value. There is a lot of contention around the idea of digital non-government-backed currencies, and a big part of that is due to their volatility. People say that, quote, these can never be currencies because they're unstable. And whilst that may be true now, they missed something fundamental. Before something can become an exchange of value, it must become a store of value. And becoming a store of value takes time, especially when it's something so disruptive to so many stakeholders in so many parts of the world. We're conditioned to think that because we're living in a technology-driven world and we can innovate at a rapid pace, that this new form of money should somehow too innovate, change, and move just as quick. And that's incorrect, because money is more like the internet than an internet company. It's a network that takes time to build. More on this later. The other argument is that it's not, quote, backed by anything. Well, the last and only real trustless store of value was gold, which is also backed by nothing, except that it's real and tangible, which there means it's safe and secure. It also happens to be relatively fungible, finite or scarce, recognizable, durable and mostly stable, and thus we all agree it has some sort of value. In fact, it's because it doesn't change that it's valuable. By the way, it also has a market capitalization or network value of more than $7 trillion, and more importantly, it took 5,000 years to get there. Bitcoin has thus far become the default digital store of value because it is censorship-resistant money with sovereign-grade protection designed to withstand an attack by a large nation-state. Bitcoin's first and most important use case will be to become a reserve asset. Security and censorship resistance are the fundamentals. Digital currencies already have the rest of the attributes. Over time, as long as the fundamentals hold true, their adoption will grow, and so too will their network value, thus giving them a real shot at being real mediums of exchange. It's not an if, it's a when. Because time and history is always on the side of networks. Which brings me to the next point. Networks. Nobody has ever successfully predicted the growth of any network that's had a significant impact on society. That may be an exaggeration, but you get my point. The most important and entrenched networks, such as electricity, the telephone, the internet, Facebook, money and value exchange. Nobody saw any of those coming, nor predicted their growth. My favorite part of looking back on the growth of each of these networks is reading these quotes. Quote, "The truth is, no online database will replace your daily newspaper. No CD-ROM can take the place of a competent teacher, and no computer network will change the way government works." End quote. American astronomer and author Clifford Stoll, 1995. Quote, "The Americans may have need of the telephone, but we do not. We have plenty of messenger boys." End quote. Sir William Preece, Chief Engineer, British Post Office, 1878. Quote, "This telephone has too many shortcomings to be seriously considered as a means of communication. The device is inherently of no value to us." End quote. A memo at Western Union in 1878. Quote, "When the Paris exhibition of 1878 closes, electric light will close with it, and no more will be heard of it." End quote. Oxford professor Erasmus Wilson. And one of my favorites. Quote, "The growth of the internet will slow drastically as the flaw in Metcalfe's law becomes apparent. Most people have nothing to say to each other. By 2005 or so, it will become clear that the internet's impact on the economy has been no greater than the fax machines." End quote. Paul Krugman, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, wrote in 1998. The same has been true for Bitcoin. Since the early days, see Bitcoin obituaries for some laughs, or this one I picked up from Wired magazine, quote, "Wired, tired, expired for 2012. Expired. Bitcoin." Complete air swings all around. But in their defense, there's a reason why this happens. There's a reason why very, very smart people get these predictions very, very wrong. Linear versus quadratic or exponential growth. The human mind has developed over hundreds of thousands of years to think and perceive linearly. Out in the savannah, when you're running from a lion, you need to be aware of how quickly you can outrun it, or you're dead. Linear thought is a survival mechanism. 30 steps equals 30 meters. Another 30 steps equals 60 meters. All up. Linear. Exponential growth is on the other end of the spectrum. It's a doubling at each step. An example we've all heard of is Moore's Law, which states that the number of transistors in an integrated circuit doubles roughly every 2 years. Tech has followed this trajectory very closely over the past 70 years and is a big reason why we've been wrong as a society on just about every prediction we've made. It's non-intuitive growth. 30 linear steps equals 30 meters. 30 exponential steps is 1 billion meters. Quadratic growth is not the same, but somewhere in between. It's best described by Metcalfe's law, which states that, quote, the number of potential connections in a network is proportional to the square of the number of participants, i.e. N2, end quote. So if there's one person in the network, there's one connection. 10 equals 100 connections. 100 equals 10,000 connections. 1,000 equals 1 million connections. 1 million equals 1 trillion connections. Neither economists, nor bankers, nor astronomers, nor any of us can really fundamentally grasp this. It's not in our DNA to do so. And to add to that, most of the training in traditional disciplines is built around linear, local concepts. So it further conditions us away from how technology and networks grow. Now here's an interesting thought. Bitcoin and real public blockchain networks are a combination of both quadratic network growth and exponential technological expansion. That only happens once in a while. In fact, the last time something so big happened was arguably the internet, although you could probably argue AWS and Facebook are good examples too. I would say the internet is more akin to Bitcoin because they're both more like utilities than companies. And despite how much it's changed the world so far, we're just scratching the surface of what's to come. Networks versus companies. With that basic overview of how network growth works, let's explore why we're getting valuations completely wrong. Networks are fundamentally different to companies' traditional capital infrastructure models. The mental models we've developed over the last 100 years to measure and analyze capital, markets, corporations, cooperatives, and more don't fit with the laws that govern networks. Networks are not companies. They don't have to worry about profit, loss, shareholders, a board, customers, or any of that. Think back to the dot-com bubble for a moment. Do you remember what happened? Web companies boomed and busted, but the internet continued to grow. In fact, it accelerated. The companies built on the internet were affected, but the underlying network, the internet, was not. We've been trained and conditioned to value things based on profits, earnings, revenues, customers, margins, returns on investment, capital allocation, etc. Networks are just not subject to the same valuation models, and hence we can't predict what their future value will look like. Networks have time on their side. Time is usually against you in the corporate world because you're fighting for market share, fighting for mind share, fighting the competition, and fighting the new startups. Something like Bitcoin, apart from a catastrophic failure, the fact that new technologies come and go doesn't really mean much. Bitcoin as a protocol is stable. Bitcoin has infrastructure. Bitcoin has security. Bitcoin is the most decentralized thing we have. Bitcoin has no head of the snake and is thus the most censorship resistant. Bitcoin is a freak accident with massive network effects in play, and as a global, digital, neutral, censorship resistant store of value is orders of magnitude ahead of anything else. So the question you should be asking when trying to evaluate this space is not, quote, how good or valuable is the technology today, but how will it evolve over time? Does it have a foundation? How valuable is a decentralized digital means of exchange that's scarce, secure, censorship-resistant, open, public, transparent, and divisible that allows people all over the world to transact value instantly, cheaply, with anyone at any time? It's a very different question that requires a new framework and a whole new set of mental models in order to measure and evaluate. Chris Burnisk is doing some fantastic work in this space, as is Brian Koraluski. 4 billion unbanked or underbanked. Before I bring this home, I'll outline an example I used at one of my talks. Nope, this is not my version of the creepy babies are dying that Roger Ver keeps referring to. And here he's got a graphic of who are the financially excluded, and it's in percentages of the adult population. So we start with South Asia with 642 million or 53% of the population is excluded from finance. Then we've got Africa and the Middle East, which 61%, but less in total, 467 million. Then we have Southeast Asia at 59%, or the lower, again, 266 million. And then China is 21%, or 238 million. In Latin America, 48% of the population at 214 million. And Eastern Europe and Central Asia at 39% excluded at 154 million people. There are graphs that segment this data further between the poor class, women in society, and then rural areas. So if you want to go dig a little deeper and kind of look at that chart so you get a visual representation, which is a whole lot easier than the audio, I definitely encourage you to check out the article and look at all the graphics that we've gone over as well as the links. One of Bitcoin's major use cases is banking the unbanked, which, if successful, will probably result in debanking the banked. Let's explore. You may have heard of the rising billion. That's 1 billion people crossing the traditional poverty line and entering the global economy. Exponential technology is already bringing them the tools they need to participate. Smartphones, wireless internet, etc. But what about banking and financial services? Well, the banks cannot and will not service them because banks are companies. They need to make money, and there is no money to be made out there. Yet. Open public decentralized protocols, networks, do not have this issue. Bitcoin doesn't care who you are, where you are, how much you have, or why you want to use it. With a phone and internet access, the unbanked will have the basic financial services that we in the developed world currently take for granted. And in fact, probably better, because they won't have to sell their privacy and souls to get access. By the time banks catch up and try to service these 4 billion people, it will already be too late. Why the hell would anyone subject themselves to the rigor, discrimination, and constraints of traditional banking when they've got something so much better? How do you think the rest of us are going to feel when we're leapfrogged? How do you think this will impact the world? What does 1 billion people do to the value of a quadratic network? I'll let you do the math. Looking ahead, what comes after money? Progressive societies, once they've worked out money, go on to build new governance structures and further layers of communication and exchange. They begin to ask the question of how can we run society better? And this is where things get interesting. We're in a world where a communication and information infrastructure has brought the first wave of massive change. And we're at the dawn of the value transfer and exchange layer atop it. What happens after that will be transformations in the key pillars of equity, morals, liberty, opportunity, innovation, identity, sovereignty, etc. We have 2,000 digital currencies today, with probably only 50 that will survive long term, because the other 1,950, apart from a large proportion being just naive and stupid or scammy, are just well before their time. They are simply not required anytime soon because money and value needs to be sorted out first, followed by the key pillars listed above. After all that's done, which will take many years, we will see layers abstracted on top of those, where millions of applications will be developed that function better in a world operating on a more modern money, decentralized form of value exchange, governance, and identity, etc. Note that there will also be a million applications that run better in their current centralized format. Not everything with blockchain at the end of it is better. In fact, much of it is worse. But the foundational elements of society, i.e. value exchange, governance, and identity, are where all of the real innovation will happen in this space. Our job is to get the base layer right first. All else comes after. Adoption to value to stability. In order for this experiment to succeed, I believe we need to do the following. 1. Increase adoption, and as a result, 2. Increase the network value, the store of value or the reserve asset, and as a result, 3. We will see this asset class stabilize, and then because of its utility, it will have a chance at being a global, open, public, instant, decentralized form of value exchange, i.e., money. What's most important now, though, is we need to place our effort in 1. 2 and 3 will happen as a result of increasing adoption. So how do we do that? Simple, but not necessarily easy. A, better on-ramps and off-ramps. We simply need to create better exchanges and better ways for people to get into the space. There is no better way for someone to learn about this new technology than to actually buy some. B, better infrastructure. This includes wallets, nodes, lightning nodes, tools such as MetaMask, etc. Once people are, quote, in the space, they need to have a better experience. Wallets, for example, have come a long way, but they have a long way yet to go. C, education. All nascent industries that boom bring with them the cowboys and snake oil salesmen in droves. You see crap like BitConnect, USI Tech, Mayweather, Steven Seagal, AI blockchains that will solve world hunger and clean your house, dentist coins, and God knows what other horseshit come out of the woodwork, and you wonder how any of this is even legal. Well, most of it isn't, and most of it is short-term noise, which will all disappear in the next crypto winter. Overdue, but much needed. But it's up to us as the people who understand something about this space to educate and explain things to the rest of the populace in ways that make sense, which I know is not easy. To this day, after years of studying, there is still no simple one-liner that explains what the f*** Bitcoin or blockchains are without opening up a Pandora's box of further questions. But we're getting there. In that vein, here's a quick list of people you should follow or subscribe to if you want to learn more. Andreas M. Antonopoulos, Naval Ravikant, Jimmy Song, Trace Mayer, Kyle Samani, Chris Berniski, Brian Koraluski, Yannick Roux, 2-Bit Idiot, Giacomo Zucco, Safedean Amos, Tur Demeester, Vitalik Buterin, Nassim Nicholas Taleb. There's more, but this is a quick list off the top of my head. Closing thoughts. My hope is that this slightly prolonged article gives you, the reader, a good foundational understanding of why Bitcoin exists, why it's important, and why it's probably not going away, and why, quote, history is now on a different trajectory than it was before. And maybe that understanding will make you realize what all the hype is about. Because despite the scammy ICOs and stupid money flying around, there actually is some real stuff here worth being excited about. Note: some might construe me as a Bitcoin maximalist after reading this article. And well, that's partially true. When it comes to money, what I'm interested in is the most decentralized, censorship-resistant store of value and subsequent opportunity for medium of exchange that will form the basis of value measure and transfer in the future. And currently, based on the research I've done over the years, not just on blockchains, but on societal evolution, the history of money, the history of humanity, etc., Bitcoin stands head and shoulders above the rest as the one with the most viable chance of success. Bitcoin's value proposition is not digital currency. Yet, 90% of existing money already exists as digital currency. Bitcoin's value proposition is its methodology in guaranteeing the trustworthiness of digital currency. I think there is scope for a different set of protocols to be optimized for a different set of use cases, which in my mind is a good idea, i.e. use the best tool for the job, and that will likely happen. Bitcoin should do store of value plus money and do that best. It's the most contentious anyway, so it's a big enough problem to solve as it is. Lastly, I want to be clear that my aim with the article was to present the conclusions I've come to thus far, based on what I've managed to procure and distill. I'm sure there is more out there, and as things progress, so too will my opinion. Note that this could have gone a hell of a lot longer, but seeing as though I have a company to build, I need to go do some work. So, whether you buy some Bitcoin through the application I'm involved in building, or any other exchange, it doesn't matter. What matters is that we adopt this new technology and spread the word. Buy some Bitcoin, or any other crypto asset or currency that you believe in. Be a user, be a node, and the network will grow faster than any of us could have imagined. Thank you. And there we have it. That was Alexander Svetsky's Homo Sapiens, Evolution, Money, and Bitcoin. How a strange species of ape went from barter to Bitcoin. I hope you guys enjoyed that one. I know that was a little bit longer than the usual episode, but I thought it was really good, and I've been sitting on it for a while and meaning to get to it so I can finally close out some of these tabs. Do not forget, I'll actually tag everybody in the Twitter post, and I may add them to the actual Podbean notes as well. Everyone that he mentioned to follow or subscribe to, because I'm pretty certain that I'm following every single person on this list, but I know of and or have heard of them, so I definitely recommend, yes, follow that whole list of people. They're bunch of great resources there, and I'm actually listening to Nicholas Taleb's Skin in the Game right now, about halfway through it, and we'll be jumping back into Safetynomics's The Bitcoin Standard. So these guys really have a lot of great work to consume. And of course, don't forget to follow Alexander Svetsky to check out his stuff on Medium, particularly since he's got this Bitcoin versus Bcash series underway. And check out the decentralizedpodcast.com.au. Like I said, I've only listened to, I think I mentioned, I've only listened to the most recent episode or a part of it. But it seems pretty good, so I might try to see if I can squeeze that into the ocean of audio that I consume throughout the day while I'm working. So, yeah, don't forget to check him out. And I'll, of course, tag him in the post and link to the page. So you can follow him on Medium and at or on Twitter. So that will close this episode. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy, and also on Medium at The Crypto Economy as well. And I had a couple people message me about the podcast. I'm having a hard time finding it on certain feeds. But if you are searching for the Crypto Economy podcast, there is actually another one with the same name, started right around the same time. They have a blue icon. Mine is the one with the headphones and the Bitcoin mug. And it's under the name Guy Swan. That's me. So, yeah, just don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. And if you have trouble finding it, that's what you're looking for. Don't forget to tell everybody else about it, because who could go without the Crypto Economy podcast? It'd be devastating. But yeah, I'll catch you guys next time. Take it easy.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.